I'm looking forward to these days very much because I don't often get a chance to sit around with sharp young minds who will puncture all the favorite ideas I have and try to bring me back to reality. What I would like to do, so far Karen has given me 6 sessions. The end goal, I think I would say, is to try to find a way of living a committed Christian life in harmony with the institutional church. Now, I think offhand that may sound like an impossible task. But, yeah. But I think there's a certain way in which we can look at this whole business which really began with our baptism as a pilgrimage which implies movement, progression, I would hope, without separation from our roots, while at the same time we hopefully are able to get a new perspective through the things that happen to us along the way. And I think we believe through the work of the Holy Spirit. When we came up last Tuesday night by taxi from Yakima to Chelan, we landed in Chelan in that terrible snowstorm and skidded off the road one time and managed to get back on and finally arrived at the Cannon Motel and met those good people there. They put us up in a very comfortable room. And on the TV, it was a TV guide. I don't know who publishes it, but I picked it up and was just paging through it. And there was a little item announcing that they were going to broadcast an interview with Golda Meir, the new heroine of Milwaukee, since she was a school teacher there many years ago. And they quoted something that she had said, or perhaps will say in the interview, which struck me as having some very good connection with what we are going to talk about. She said there are 2 things that a Jew, and particularly an Israeli, cannot afford. One is to become tired, and the other is to become pessimistic. And in a way, I suppose that would apply as well to all of us in the pilgrimage with Christ. We can't afford to become tired, and we can't afford to be pessimistic. In spite of all the things that happen to us along the way, and which sometimes make us wonder whether it's all worthwhile. In the course of this week and perhaps part of next week, I'd like to give you a little picture at least of what has happened to me over the years and why I have come to the point at which I am and what that has to say about our understanding of the institutional church, particularly, I suppose, the Lutheran church, and what that means for our involvement, our membership in the total body of Christ without any specific labels attached to it. Before going into too much autobiography, I should say that if you have any questions or anything you want to say along the way, feel free to break in. If you do that, please say your name again. I think I know most of the names, but I don't know which faces they belong to, so that if you, it'll help a little bit, at least to help me. Perhaps you all know who you are. I said the other night, Friday night, that after graduation from seminary in St. Louis in 1930, Gladys and I were sent out to India as missionaries. I think in some Christian circles, you have the impression that people get a tremendously exciting call to become missionaries, you know, like a flash of light. All at once you feel committed to a great adventure, etc. Well, that didn't happen. My father's cousin was on the faculty of the seminary in St. Louis, and he hired me as his secretary as a favor to my father so I could earn a little money. And that work consisted of preparing his church history notes for him, so he didn't have to do it. I put it all on cards so that he could just take it into class and lecture. Well, about 2 weeks before graduation, I came into his office and he said, Martin, how would you like to go to India? I said, I don't mind. And then when the board met, which handed out the calls, I was one of those who was sent to India. Gladys and I, in those days, you were not allowed to, in the first place, you were not supposed to be conscious of the fact that there was another sex in the world. And above all, you were not to have any relationships of any kind. But we had a kind of an understanding, so I had to write and ask her and her father what they thought about going to India. And her father was a good churchman. He knew something about foreign mission work. He knew that the missionaries in a place like India had servants who did the cooking. And he said, lucky for you, because she doesn't know how to cook. Well, that summer then we got married, naturally, and a couple of weeks later left for India. The point I want to make is that at least in those days, we had no preparation at all. I think if I look back on the kind of seminary training I had, it fitted me more or less adequately, I suppose, to be pastor in a small congregation in central Illinois. That was about the size of it. You know, how to preach, how to console people, a little bit of stewardship, but nothing really that could in any way be considered a preparation for work in an entirely different culture and in the midst of people whose whole life was centered on an entirely different value system than the Christian system that we knew. So that I think most of us who went out in those days had to react perhaps in two ways. One was to try to transplant what we knew about Christian life, Christian faith, Christian culture in America to the Indian situation. Simply move it, foundation, walls, steeple and everything, into that country and try to get people to respond positively to it. That reaction, I think, was based on the fact that we knew nothing about what we saw there. We knew nothing about Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, animism, all the great world religions, and the kind of life which grew out of those systems. And therefore, since we didn't understand them, our reaction was, they don't matter. They have no meaning. And as I look back on what happened, I think most of us, and I'm not only talking about a small Lutheran mission operation, but most Western churches, mission societies, reacted in the same way. We simply erected anti-institutions, those structures which would somehow satisfy the goals which we had in mind without any relationship to what was already there. And I suppose that perhaps an unconscious goal was that if we could erect these anti-institutions in a successful way, the other institutions which were there would simply wither away, would die as our own structures grew. And I think if I look over mission history, most of a very large majority of those who were sent from the West, particularly, into those countries, followed that plan. Perhaps not according to a blueprint, but simply because that was what we knew and were comfortable with. The other reaction, and there were some notable examples of this, was a desire to try to understand what was there, to try to understand how people had lived for thousands of years without our contribution, if you put that in quotes, and what kind of a world view controlled their lives as a result of their adherence to another religious system. Now, I don't think this is black and white in the sense that some people had only the first reaction and some people had only the second reaction. There was always a great deal of overlapping, and perhaps in the case of some, I know, in the case of some outstanding scholars, the second reaction, this desire to know, to understand what was there, was very strong, and as a result of that, some very good in-depth studies of other world systems did result. But I think you can get a picture of what, now I'm talking, you know, almost a half a century ago, of what kind of a reaction one must have when you're suddenly plunged into an entirely different world, and you begin only very slowly and very timidly, I would say, to try to see what makes it work. How does it happen that such a vast mass of people have been born, have lived, and have died in different systems without ever having come in contact with what we, from our Western Christian standpoint, felt and perhaps understood to be the only real meaning and purpose of man's existence, person's existence, men and women existence. I think the when I say that the initial reaction to this kind of thing was very timid, I have to say that because those many of you who are considerably younger cannot understand, or cannot at least fully appreciate, the weight of tradition in a particularly a Missouri Synod family of very traditional viewpoints on, you know, on the world, on religion, or whatever. I think I was more or less a product, an average product of a preacher's family in those days. We, all of the brothers, used to talk jokingly about that we were not really preacher's kids, we were products of the tube. That is, when we were 6 years old, our father put us into the parochial school system, through which we went for 8 years, and then the junior college and seminary. And after 17 years, you emerged from the other end of the tube, and you were, you were a minister. And in the meantime, you were so enclosed in this system that you knew very little about what was happening in the world, didn't ask many questions, and you really came out thoroughly convinced that you had all the answers, there were no open questions, and all you had to do was to transmit this great wisdom to other people. I suppose I say that now with a little bit of sorrow, because I think things could have been much better. But I have to say it because it made it so very difficult for, I think, most of us, and I again speak of the whole spectrum of Protestant missionaries, it made it so difficult for us to take a different standpoint, so in a sense to sort of move out of our skin into another position, so that you would be free to take another look. I don't want to get too autobiographical, but I think in my own experience, and that may illustrate something, that in that first tour of duty in South India, the first, in those days we had 7.5 years for a term, and then we were given some leave in the United States. It was about the middle of that first term when I became very skeptical about almost everything that I had learned or had been taught at the seminary in St. Louis in those days. The whole theological system was a closed system. Every possible question had been answered completely, and the only thing we had to do was to make sure that we knew the answers. But when I was put into that situation, and I know I shared this with a number of other missionaries also, we found that we were, our education, at least for that type of service in the church, was totally inadequate. And I remember, in fact I still have most of the correspondence, writing to a number of friends here in America, trying to say what was happening to me. And one of them was my brother, who later became president of Valparaiso University, but who was at that time the executive secretary of the old Walther League, the Young People's Organization in the Missouri Synod. And he was never known to be very good about correspondence. In fact, the second brother always used to say that O.P. never learned to write. That was his problem. In this case, he was faithful in trying to... I think he recognized a cry for help. His kid brother was out there and going through a very difficult time, and he did respond very often and at some length. And I guess the sum and substance of his response to my questions about the significance and the importance of the kind of dogmatics that we had been taught in the seminary, and all the questions that arise when you find different religious systems having different answers to the same problems, yeah. The sum and substance of his answer was, evidently there are things in this world which the Missouri Synod doesn't know very much about. That was an understatement. But he said, in the end, he said, I sympathize with the agony that you're going through, but in the end, what are you going to do with Jesus Christ? And this came again and again in variations, but just about the same question. And I suppose that perhaps there were other factors as well, but that was perhaps one of the most important factors that made me begin to unload a great deal of baggage. No one who was not brought up in the Missouri Synod a half century ago can understand how heavy the 3-volume edition of Franz Pieper's Dogmatics was. Came out in 3 volumes plus an index volume. Must have weighed about 10 pounds altogether, but I'm not talking about that weight. The weight of that tradition on us, that the whole world was explained in Pieper's Dogmatics. And except, I believe, for one very slight reference to non-Christian religions, he seems to have been either unaware of other religions or seems to have decided to ignore them. That one reference is that Some people have pointed out that there are good things in other religions. And the only way we can understand that is that the devil has placed these good things in the other religions in order to deceive us. That was approximately the substance of his contribution to the understanding of world religions. And that's why I say the weight of that three-volume Dogmatics was so great that it took years to, and every time when there was a slight feeling of moving away from it, a terrible sense of guilt, you know, what am I, losing the moorings, losing the foundation, and all of these guilt feelings in one who had been brought up in that tradition. I think what did help a great deal was the fact that there were one or two other souls who had gone through the same experience or through the same problems and demonstrated that it was possible to shed a great deal of what I would now call, you know, our Western baggage without losing the heart, the core of the Christian faith. The experience that we had several times when we came to America for leave was not all that uplifting. We were on furlough in 38, 39, again in 46, 47, then in 54, then in 60, and then finally in 63, came over for a special assignment. But those furlough periods, which we looked forward to with so much anticipation, not only meeting the family again and meeting old friends, but looking forward to the opportunity of sitting down quietly with some, you know, empathetic people and discussing the problems that were involved in the assignment to preach the gospel to people like Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists. And that was a great disappointment, because, again, with one or two notable exceptions, we found that the people here in America either didn't have the time or they didn't have enough points of reference. Some very outstanding churchmen were willing to commit themselves to a discussion of this, but it became evident very quickly, within a few minutes, that wasn't their world. They couldn't understand what the problem was. And I often had the feeling after a few minutes that I was impinging on this man's busy time schedule. He had some kind of meetings he had to go to, and he couldn't spend the time talking to a poor missionary. So in that sense, I think these trips back to America were disappointing, and also they were rather unsettling. Usually the missionaries who come on furlough are expected to do what is called deputy work, which meant that you were assigned a certain either a certain area of the country or a certain type of congregation, which you had to visit and tell the story about foreign mission work. And telling the story meant getting people to give money for missions. I made the mistake a couple of times of trying to get away from the, you know, what they used, what the pastors always said, what we want is personal interest stories, you know, how you rescued somebody from the clutches of the devil and saved his soul, etc. And something like that did happen, but that wasn't the big thing. The big thing was, you know, how are we to understand what is happening out there? And a couple of times when I did try to introduce that either into a sermon or into some kind of a mission lecture, the pastor would take me aside and he says, "That's your problem. Our problem is to raise money, see, and that doesn't raise money. What you want to do is get the ladies weeping about these poor heathen. That brings in the money." And I suppose, being a good organization man, I very often did exactly that. I could tell stories that would tear the heartstrings. True, I didn't lie, but at the same time, always had the feeling this isn't the whole story. There's something else besides this. So what is all this about? Why am I telling you all this? I think because, in a way, what a person who was sent into a strange and different culture undergoes is not all that unusual. I think that a great many of you people here in America, or perhaps I should say all of you, would have the same kind of experience if it was shocking enough, if what you saw outside of the church in the world around us was so striking, so totally different from your experience within the church, that you were shocked at seeing it, almost as if, you know, you got an electric shock of some kind. Because as I have lived back in the States for 15 years and have that other perspective behind me, I don't think it is all that different. The kind of things that we find in our context here in America are in a sense the same, but the church and the society around it are at least so superficially similar that we're not shocked by it. Whereas in a place like India, you know, you have this little body of Christian people in a vast sea of non-Christians and different symbols of worship and all that, so that you see a contrast, a very black and white situation, and therefore have to begin asking questions about how these two things relate to each other. But that isn't the case in America. I mean, that shocking aspect is not there. And therefore, I think the church, by and large, is not too excited about the context in which it operates or it works, and doesn't do very much about it. Now, I am not saying at this point or advocating a crusade of some kind, but merely trying to say that if we are committed to Jesus Christ, if we believe that the gospel is something that is the only thing that can bring men into the abundant life in God's world, then we have to understand the context in which we are to proclaim the gospel. I think that what happened to me, as well as to a number of others, was that we were driven back into a study of the scriptures, not from the viewpoint of checking out again the various proof passages that were in the catechism or that we had been taught to use as weapons. That was a very favorite phrase in those days. But in an attempt to understand what God is up to in the world, what's he been doing all this time? And if he has been doing it, if he has been doing something, what connection has that with what we believe he has been doing in and through the church? And the other thing, I think, particularly as Lutherans, we were driven back into a study of the classic Lutheran confessions, to which we committed ourselves at the time of our ordination, and which were, for the most part, simply some kind of a Sunday jacket that would be taken out of the closet a couple times a year, and some reference would be made to it, but they were not really very functional. But if the Lutheran confessions were supposed to be a proper understanding of the scriptures, and particularly of the gospel, then they ought to have something very important to say to the context in the world, the context into which we had been placed. I think out of this twofold pressure, I mean the twofold result of the pressure upon us, the being driven back into the scriptures and being driven back into the confessions, I think most of us began to take an entirely different viewpoint on the nature of Lutheranism and its function in the world, as well as on the nature of the Christian Church, speaking from an institutional viewpoint, and its function in the world. I don't know if I can say this in words so that you get a picture in your minds. I'm going to show some slides this Friday night, and perhaps you get some viewpoint there. But let me speak from a personal experience. For practically the first 18 years of our life in India, we were involved in, Gladys and I were involved in preaching in Hindu villages, street preaching, and establishing congregations when some people expressed their willingness to learn more and to become Christians. There was always some success, a few people, perhaps in some cases a larger number of people, but it was inevitable that you would ask the question, for example, in the town where we spent most of our early years, the town was roughly 50% Hindu and 50% Muslims, Mohammedans, with a very small Christian congregation on the outskirts. Most of the people who were not Christians were high caste Hindus and Muslims who very seldom became Christian. So that you ask yourself, what does it mean for this little group of Christians, perhaps 30, 40, 50, to gather on a Sunday morning for worship and other times during the week for other programs? What does that mean in the light of this total family of God in that place, the Hindus and the Muslims? Was it God's will that all of these people should come into the church as become baptized and become Lutherans in that case? Or was it God's will that this little flock, poor, economically very depressed, socially outcast, that this little group was to be in that place as a symbol, a sign of some kind to God's relationship to the world? Or was it possible to believe that God was related to the whole world and that he was carrying out some kind of plan? Something was happening through these other religions, which in some way, the moment I leave it at that, say some way, was also related to his revelation of himself in Jesus Christ. I think you can begin to get an idea of how unsettling this can be, and how both the size and the number of questions that arise would drive a person to despair. This did happen in the case of a number of missionaries, both in the Lutheran communion and in others, who spent a few years there and said, the questions are too big, I can't take them, and then would return to the United States and take a parish someplace without questions. I mean, you could get involved enough in building a parish and being active in Christian life and work without asking a great many questions. But I come back again to what I said before, that I, after being over here now for a number of years and seeing what you might almost say the church from the inside, I think we are all facing the same problems.
Excuse me, can I ask something?
Surely you can, sure.
I'm Keith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What I'm hearing you say now, the first time you said that, I heard you say that the church here in the U.S. is in, if not a hostile context, at least one that doesn't really, the church hasn't seen the great difference that it means to not be in the church, and that perhaps those on the outside also don't have any picture of what's going on in here. But this time, and when you said, if I hear you correctly, and that's why I wanted to find out now, that you said the other religions, you know, do they have a function in God's plan? That you said the other religions, you know, do they have a function in God's plan? And I'm wondering if now we could ask, say if I could ask, not having been in a foreign country, could I ask that same question, could I ask, is there something in the secular society that God is up to? I mean, is there a parallel there?
Yes, I think so. I'm going to come to that.
Okay, I didn't. Okay,
as you heard correctly.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know quite.
But I think I said before. I said in that connection, or I should have said, that for the moment I'm just going to leave it as a question. Yeah, something like that. Thank you, Keith. I said from the experience of, you know, looking at the church from the inside. I have at another time when I was giving a paper, I quoted something which I think is a little bit amusing, and maybe I'm going to stop with that. I was reading someplace, this was a paper on mission and ministry in context, which I gave down in St. Louis last year, and I had been reading Victor de Waal's little book, What is the Church? I think it's in the SCM series. And he has this incident in there. Günter Grass has written a novel, The Tin Drum. And Oscar is the anti-hero. Oscar has wandered to the public park where a Nazi rally is to be held. And things are being prepared, and so he wanders around before the banners and the trumpets and everything, all that gets going, and he wanders around behind the rostrum, and then he says, have you ever seen a rostrum from behind? Everyone should be familiarized with the rear view of a rostrum before being assembled in front of one. Anyone who has ever really looked at a rostrum from behind will be immunized at once and be proof against any magic which in one form or another is practiced on rostrums. Now, I brought that in connection with having seen the church from the inside. That, in a sense, is looking behind the rostrum. And I don't say it in order to denigrate the whole system, because I don't see how we can operate without it. But I think all of us, whatever our situation in the church, in the fellowship is, have to be aware of the fact that much of what comes out toward us is, to a greater or less degree, conditioned by the objectives, the goals of the people who are making the presentation. In saying that, I have to include myself in the company of the guilty people, because I know very well that very often in the former days, I would be asked to speak about the mission to a particular group of people, and my objective would be to make them feel very sympathetic, very generous for the mission program, so that it would be a successful operation. And I think I did it with a good conscience, but every now and then I wonder whether the desire, and perhaps you might almost say the necessity, to manipulate people is allowable in the Christian proclamation. I have been in sacristies, mostly Lutheran, of course, in the country, where the pastor would very frankly, very openly say that his intention in his sermon was so and so, in terms of what he wanted, the kind of response he wanted to get from people. And in the process, the gospel, the proclamation of the grace of God in Christ would be so handled as to bring about the goals that he had in mind. I'm not saying this to make you suspicious of everything that you hear, and that can very easily happen, but to point out to each of you who are engaged in the process of being witnesses, of being proclaimers, that we are all subject to the same temptations, and that we can only, at least to some extent, escape from that kind of condemnation if we are willing to submit ourselves totally to the welfare of the other person. Not to see how we can manipulate that person for our ends, but to be sure that that person shares in the grace and love of God in Christ. So I think this is about the framework, the context out of which I have to speak to you in the coming days about some of the other things that I think we have to look at. But I hope that it helps you to understand why I am at this point, what brought me here, and I think by the grace of God, what brought me through. Okay, any questions? Anything ought to be said some more? Talk about?
I just, when you began speaking, I just thought of one thing that I heard here once. You talked about God working, God's people and God's plan working all over, outside the church as well as inside it. And a couple of years ago, we had Vern Viatai here from St. Olaf College on the faculty, and he gave a series of lectures from John, and he called them Grace Upon Grace. Mm-hmm. And some of what I got from that was that God's grace has been acting in the world always, and the Christian message adds grace upon the grace that God bestowed on those people before. It's mm-hmm. not all just wiped away, but the idea of grace upon grace.
I think that's where I'm coming to, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the question we have to ask beyond that, we'll have to deal with later, but what does it mean then to have a fellowship of Christians admitted to that fellowship by baptism, mm-hmm. and how do these two things relate to each other? That gets to be a real stickler.
You mean because baptism is seen as a gateway or an entry into something new, and how do you see a continuity that
yeah,
way?
Yes, that's yeah. the problem, I think. Mm-hmm. I can just maybe close with one little incident which is stuck in my mind. A few years ago I was in Nigeria, and we had a man there who had originally been in the traditional mission program, but then became head of the Islam in Africa project, and he was stationed at Ibadan, which is a big African city, has a big university, and is, I was told, the largest African city in the world, as has not been westernized, it's just purely African. And it just stretches for miles and miles all over the desert. And in the center there is just a little promontory, a little rise in the, and we drove up there and stood there and looked over it in all directions, far as you could see, houses. And he said, with the exception of about 20 people who came in from the outside and were engaged in some government positions who were Christians, with the exception of those, all the rest are Muslims. I don't know what it does to you if you just try to picture that. I said to him, Bob, do you think it's God's plan that all of them should become members of the Christian church in terms of, you know, association with an institutional expression of the church? And he said, we couldn't handle it. And I think that's true, you know, there were, I think, about 2 million people there. So we couldn't handle it. Well, then, of course, you've got to go on from there to something else. You can't stop there. But just to visualize, he said, we'd have to build a church seating approximately 1,000 people about every half mile on the road, you know. Now, what is it? I mean, I think that's part of the search that we ought to, and with regard to our own situation here in the States and the world around us.
That, too, isn't it... That shows how we frame our questions from within our own world. I mean, it's impossible to think about them being Christians without us somehow having to be responsible for building churches and
yeah.
and somehow. I mean, that interests me because I saw that happen in just our home parish, my parents' home parish there, where they could have used the church building, for example. I don't know, this doesn't really apply, it maybe isn't that good of an analogy, but I mean, always the feeling that somehow, you know, you've got to be responsible for doing something. I wonder, too, I'm sure you're going to probably elaborate on, but I don't know the outline that you've got, but you as you talked, I wondered about this, you mentioned it already, you might have, you had in front of you the question your brother said to you, what are you going to do with Jesus? And in front of your eyes you've got all these people, and you can see them through the grace of God. You can see them through that grace.
Right.
But then what happens when you've got to try to talk about it? Are you going to talk about how that works? How do you relate? I mean, their whole background has little or no contact with the whole development of the thought.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And how do you, do Indian people understand, I mean, is forgiveness of sin even, I mean, as important as that is to us, is it possible to translate that into anything that has any meaning?
Yeah. But it isn't all that simple either. Yeah, there are all kinds of things are clustered around that. Yes, I want to talk about that.
Super.
Mary? Oh,
it's apropos, this morning, I was studying talking to Schumacher, we were studying the section where John, in the 12th chapter, Jesus said, "I will draw all men to myself." And we wondered, you know, what really does this mean? Did he just mean the Greeks as well as the Jews? Or mm-hmm. is this to be taken that all men will be drawn to him? Barbara pointed out that she, well, maybe I'll let her speak for herself. That Jesus did come and conquer Satan and death and evil.
Yeah.
That he is the prince of eternity, whereas Satan still might be the prince of this world. But that God, that Jesus has all of eternity to work, and that perhaps we don't know what, well, we don't know what he's going to be doing with all these Muslims and Hindus in eternity. You know, we have such a very short span of time in which we think.
He's done a lot of other things, you know. His son died and was raised again, and I mean, there's, we can't grasp the immensity of his plan, I don't think. And he may, you know, all those people out there, you know, but that's our thought, that's our culture. Yeah. And then their culture is so steeped in their thoughts, they're probably saying, no, you guys are all wrong, you've got to become Muslim. You know, that's the thing that, I don't think we can, you know, standing firm to our beliefs, we believe that they will be taken into God's family.
Yeah.
But it's such a, it might be, you know, years and years and years.
Yeah, I think what we are driven to, if we begin to open it up and to those questions, is to examine our Christian faith as to what is that element in it which simply cannot be surrendered. And then how is that related to what God has done in other, amongst other peoples and so on.
In irony, it's like what you're saying, you know, like your approach, and like what the whole church's approach, that, you know, we have the right religion, and we have to convert the Muslims and all that. I remember one of the billboards at school, there's like Muslim propaganda, and it's just really, and I'm chuckling to myself, because it's like, they're pointing out how, we as Christians, we're half right, and we're close.
Uh-huh.
But you know, we have to go one step further and become Muslim. And, yeah, and then we would have it. You know,
yeah.
And it's you know, irony, but the same way that we feel about
sure.
Muslims, it's really
powerful. Yeah. There is a branch in Hinduism. It's largely the Ramakrishna Mission, which grew out of that great Congress on World Religions held in Chicago in 1893. And that Ramakrishna Mission was a result of that. And they do active mission work, try to get converts to Hinduism. And they adopt exactly the same, all the methods that we used as Christians. And same language, same vocabulary. You know?
Did you ever feel like when Paul wrote, to the Jews I become, or to the, you know, all things to all people, where he speaks of his mission work, did you ever feel that way?
Yeah.
You have to the Muslims, or you had to become one of them?
Yeah.
Is that, how old is that religion? I mean, that's as old as time, isn't it?
Islam, you know, Islam is 650, somewhere around, after Christ.
And what about Muslims?
That's Muslims, yeah. Hinduism goes back to, well, Hinduism in its present form to about 500 B.C., but its roots go back to about 2000 B.C., the time of the Vedas. Their sacred books are, some of them, the oldest portions are about 2000 B.C. We can talk a little bit about that. I didn't intend to give you a course on world religions, but I taught it for a number of years.
Are there any parallels between Christian religion and theirs? Like,
well, I think when you say Christian religion, that's another question. But whether there are parallels in our sacred literature, yes, all kinds. I mean, they have a creation story, and there's a redemption story in Hinduism. Very strange to our thinking, but it's there. Krishna, one of the manifestations of of Vishnu, one of the, there's a trinity in Hinduism, and Vishnu is the preserver, the redeemer. One of his incarnations was Krishna. Krishna saw that the whole world was being poisoned by evil in it, and so he absorbed the world into himself and he turned blue. But all the evil was taken out of the world. Very grotesque in a way, but the idea behind it is that it has to come, rescue has to come from the outside. Somebody else has to do it. But that really opens up a whole question, a whole area for discussion. Okay, thank you. I think we're
Thank you.
It's about time.